Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Kwok Ting test when we come back. You know, we Americans may hold the dubious honor of being the most litigious people in the world. But when it comes to law, we seem to be among the most ignorant. Today, most Americans feel powerless to resist the evils that they see perpetrated against our liberties, our privacy, and our property by these powerful government agencies and multinational corporations, lobbies, and the news media. But you know, we don't have to remain helpless. The institution which was designed by God and then incorporated into our Constitution and Bill of Rights is called the judicial power. The courts are the proper repository for the protection of our rights, our liberties, and our property. It doesn't come from the Congress, and it doesn't come from the political process. Now, did you know that the privilege against self-incrimination, for example, is neither accorded to the passive resistant nor to the person who is ignorant of his rights, not to one who is indifferent thereto, because it is a fighting clause. Its benefits can be retained only by sustained combat, and it cannot be claimed by your attorney or solicitor, and it is valid only when insisted upon by a belligerent claimant in person. Now, that comes from a case called United States versus Johnson, which is why I contend that we ought to listen more to the judges and a whole lot less to the politicians and the lawyers. Now, did you hear what that judge said in that statement? He said, your rights cannot be claimed by your attorney or your solicitor. Your rights have to be claimed by you, the belligerent claimant, in person. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. And it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure, our school, is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for your free general law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we're talking about the Kwok Ting test. Kwok Ting, if you're just joining us in the dialogue here. Kwok Ting was a Chinese fellow. He was 16 years old, came back to the United States after being gone for 6 years. That was his story. And the Supreme Court didn't buy his story. And they came up with a three-part test back in 1891. It isn't something that was just developed in 1891. It actually had been developed over centuries of time. But it was delineated down to these three salient points. When you're listening to somebody's story, their testimony, it has to be complete. We can't have fragments of the story with great gaping holes in it. Number two, the testimony has to contain some extemporaneous detail. That is, after you've told your story, when somebody comes back and asks you some details about it. For instance, you might tell a story about your life in Los Angeles, California. And we've listened to your story. And now we ask some extemporaneous detail. Did you go to school while you were living in Los Angeles? Oh, yes, I went to school. What was the name of the school that you went to? Oh, gee, I can't remember. Well, that may be true. You might not remember the name of the school that you went to, but what grade were you in when you went to school in Los Angeles? Well, I was in the third grade. Who was your third grade teacher? Oh, gee, I can't remember my third grade teacher. You know, those extemporaneous details are very important. If you'd have been a resident of Los Angeles, you know, what year was it that you lived in Los Angeles, or years? Oh, it was back in the 40s. You see, those answers are so general and so lacking that we would begin to doubt that you lived in Los Angeles during these years. Maybe you didn't live there at all. Maybe you're lying. And finally, number three, your testimony must be supported by witnesses or evidence. Well, now, you know, sometimes a story can be told that is pretty old, pretty ancient. For instance, I tell this story from time to time. Listen to this story, and let's see if we can identify number three, and then we can go back and we can use extemporaneous testimony or complete testimony to corroborate what I'm telling you. When I was a little boy, about 5 years old, the Ronnie Mitchell, neighbor boy, he was also about five, suggested to me that we go down to the creek over by the schoolyard and go fishing. Now, I'd never been fishing in my life, but Ronnie had. His daddy had taken him fishing on several occasions, and so Ronnie was pretty experienced at fishing. I'd never done it in my life. And Ronnie assured me that he could show me how to fish, and so Ronnie had a fishing pole. And we went out, and I didn't have a fishing pole, and so we had to break a stick off and tie a string onto it, you know, the fishing line, and there had to be a leader, you know, that fine filament. And so he tied the knots in the filament for me. I couldn't tie knots, but he could. And so he put a hook on it, you know, a very tiny hook, and we went fishing. Now, we had to have bait, and so he tipped over rocks, and we found worms, and we found little bugs and grubs under the rocks down alongside the creek, which was pretty revelatory. In other words, you get your bait right out there on the job. And so we went fishing, and boy, did we catch fish. I mean, there were just schools and schools and oodles of fish, and we probably caught 235 fish. Yep, we caught 235 fish. Now, Ronnie probably caught about two-thirds of them, maybe more, and I caught maybe a third, maybe a little less. We had a great time and took the fish home, and we divided the fish up 50-50. We took the 235 fish and we divided them in half. And he got his half, I got my half. And then I took my fish home. Now, remember, I didn't catch half the fish, but I got half the fish. My granny was just tickled to death, and so Mrs. Mitchell, that's Ronnie's mama, she didn't want to gut and prepare all these fish, her child Ronnie's half. And so Ronnie came over to our house with his half and said, "My mom don't want these fish." And so she said, "Bring them over here to the Gordons." And so my granny now had all the fish, and she fixed them just like sir fish, just left the guts in them and the heads on, cooked them the way they were. We just ate them right there at the table. And that was my fishing experience, my very first fishing experience, and there's the story. Now, let's suppose that we want to examine that story. And as an examination, you need to cross-examine me. Is my story complete? Well, there might be some more of the story that you might want to question me on. Are there factors in there that might lend themselves to asking me questions about extemporaneous detail? And then finally, the testimony must be supported by witnesses and evidence. Now, that occurred back in 1944, so it's pretty difficult for me to put my finger on Ronnie Mitchell today. I don't have a clue as to where Ronnie might be living or where he's at. And what kind of evidence would I have? The fish have already been eaten, and I don't have the old fishing pole, the stick that we probably a willow stick or something on that order that I used as my fishing pole. So how are we going to cross-examine little Georgie Gordon now, 60 years later or more, and then come to a conclusion? Is this story true or is it false? Now remember, we already looked at the problem of 25% of the testimony is false immediately after the event transpires. And then, of course, this is a story of an event that occurred in my childhood 60 years ago. And so, over a period of 60 years, it flattens out. You can't remember half of the story. Half of the story is false after 6 months to a year. And then, from then on, the story becomes embedded in your subconscious mind. And it'll stay there forever. You can repeat this story over and over. I tell this story, I think, every time I do my cross-examination class. So I always tell my students this story over here and then invite them to pick it apart. Take this story apart. And can we corroborate it, or can we destroy the story? So starting off, the testimony must be complete. Well, you've heard all of the testimony that I can recall. And so testing to see whether the story is complete, you might ask questions, well, where did this creek, or where was this creek located? Well, it was a creek that was located next to the playground at the school in Corbell, California. And where is Corbell, California? Well, it's in Humboldt County, about 8 miles northeast of Arcata, California. And what county is this located in? Well, it's Humboldt County. And what's the county seat of Humboldt County? Well, it's Eureka. Now, you could continue on with a line of questioning as to the geographical location and other factors, like what's the biggest river that this creek might empty into? And the answer is Mad River. And how big a river is Mad River? Well, that's kind of a subjective question. How big is the river? It's in wintertime, it gets big and fast flowing in a rainstorm, and in the summertime, you can walk across it. It's bigger than a creek, but it's not as big as a river that we think about, like the Mississippi River, or Missouri River, or Yellowstone River. It's called Mad River, but it's fairly small. It probably would be 50 feet across, you know, in a normal flat spot there at Corbell. Now, I've met that testimony must be complete pretty well. Now, the testimony must contain extemporaneous detail. I covered some pretty extemporaneous detail in describing the county seat, the geographical location. It's located on the north coast of California. Now, let's take a look at the testimony must be supported by witnesses and evidence. Now, we don't have any witnesses or evidence. And yet, that's one of the tests. So, on cross-examination, we take this extemporaneous detail and we meld that with the testimony must be supported by witnesses and evidence. Let's see if we've got some witnesses and evidence here that we can put together. Now, you remember I said this occurred when I was 5 years old, so I hadn't been to school yet. Also testified that there were 235 fish. So, doesn't it strike you as odd that here's a little kid, two little kids, 5 years old, haven't been to school yet, divided these fish in two, could they count to 235? That's a pretty legitimate question. And the answer is no, neither one of us could count to 235. Well, then how do you know that there were 235 fish there? And the answer is because my grandmother told me. She counted the fish. She was amazed that we'd caught so many fish. All very small fish. They're probably 4 or 5 inches long, you know, just 3, 4, 5 inches. They're tiny, you know. And So my granny told me that it was 235 fish. We couldn't count them, but we divided them in half, remember? Well, if you couldn't count, how did you divide them in half? It was one for you and one for me. One for you, one for me. One for you, one for me. That's the way we divided them. Wouldn't have any other way to do it. Now notice we can answer those questions. I mean, that's, it's a true story. I mean, I'm not pulling your leg here or lying to you. But we already know that 25% of the story is false. But you see, here's what your problem is. I actually believe the story. And I don't know what's true and what's false. It was many years ago. That's what I remember of the story. What's the name of the creek that flows down into Mad River? I don't know. I don't know if it has a creek, a name or not. So, when you don't know the answer, then the answer is, I don't know. And what was the name of your third grade teacher? Well, my third grade teacher was Mrs. Wiles. And what was the name of the school? It was the West Vermont School. Well, I've had students here, and we'll ask them questions. Can you remember your third grade teacher? And sometimes people cannot remember the third grade teacher. For instance, I can't remember my second grade teacher's name. I can picture her in my mind. It was at the Marshall School, and it was in room 4. I can't remember that woman's name. I remember the principal's name was Ellen Knudsen, Mrs. Knudsen. And I can remember my first grade teacher's name was Mrs. Sorensen. So there's some things you can remember and there's some things that you can't. Now the fallacies of testimony come into light when somebody invents a name. Like, oh, well, your second grade teacher, I was Mrs. Jones. Now that's a lie. I can't remember my second grade teacher's name, but I can remember the first and third. And sometimes people, in their testimony, will then say, well, I should be able to remember my second grade teacher's name, and nobody else will know, so I'm just going to put in Mrs. Jones. Now, you need to remember that when you do this on deposition, your opponent is going to check that out. He's probably going to call the Marshall School in Eureka, California, and ask, well, if you started school in 1944, if you're this old... Well then, first grade was 1944-45. Second grade would have been 1945-46, wouldn't it? So you go to the Marshall School and you ask them, did you have a student there by the name of Georgie Gordon? And they'll say, yes, yes. And they'll look up the record and they'll find, yeah, there's little Georgie right here. And what was this second grade school teacher's name? And now remember, I said it's Mrs. Jones. And then they say, no, it was Mrs. Lockhart. And already you've lied, see? You can say, well, I made a mistake. Okay, well, how many of those mistakes are you going to be allowed? How many of those mistakes add up to false testimony? Now, a witness should answer the questions yes, no, and I don't know. Yes, no, and I don't know. Yes, no, and I don't know. Occasionally, you may be asked a question that requires a description of some kind, in which you might be asked to describe how you made this fishing pole when you were 5 years old. And the answer to that is, well, Ronnie, I didn't know how to make one, so Ronnie made it for me. He just reached up and he pulled on a limb and broke it down and peeled it off. And there was the stick. And then we had a hard time breaking off the end of it, which was too tiny to hold the fishing pole. And so he'd used a rock and he beat that end until it beat itself off, or he beat it off with a rock. And then we just tied the string onto the end of it, the fishing line, and then he tied the leader onto the fishing line, and then he tied the hook onto the leader, and I was in business. That's the way he did that, and I observed it. Now, I know how to make a fishing pole by just going out here to a willow. And you're asking me, well, how do you know it was a willow? I don't. I think it was a willow tree bush alongside creeks. You know how these willows grow along the creeks. You could come along and say, well, it was, are you a botanist? Do you know that it was a willow tree? And I don't know. Didn't have to be. So when you don't know, or if you're asked a question that requires a narrative answer, you need to keep it short and simple and describe what you recollect. Because that memory of Ronnie Mitchell making the fishing pole is pretty vivid in my mind after all these years. The fishing expedition, the whole trip was pretty vivid. Now, I will concede that more than likely, 25% of my story is either forgotten, it's incorrect. I mean, if we had a videotape of that whole episode, you know, the story might be somewhat different. And I couldn't argue much with the videotape, except that, you know, 1944 we didn't have videos, but we did have Brownie home movies. It could have been recorded on film. Now, even though we don't have Ronnie Mitchell and we don't have the fishing pole, we don't have the his daddy's fishing box to carry the fish in, we do have my memory, we do have my parole evidence, and we do have a complete story with extemporaneous detail. Now, you could sit there and ask me other questions concerning my story, and this is the gist of cross-examination. The heart and core of cross-examination is, and extemporaneous statements is that the witness does not know what you're going to ask about that story. And so in your mind, you may come up with 10, 15, 20 other questions. What triggers your mind that would say, well, I would ask this question. I would ask this question or that question or some other questions. And that's good, because all of those questions concerning the extemporaneous detail of the day, what kind of a day was it? How long were you out fishing? I mean, there's all kinds of things you could ask. And, of course, the witness needs to answer the questions truthfully. Do you remember whether the day was a bright, sunshiny day or whether it was overcast? I'm trying to remember now. I really can't remember whether it was bright, sunshiny, or overcast. What month of the year was this? We hadn't gone to school yet, so it had to be in June, July, or August, sometime in the summer prior to school, which started the day after Labor Day in September 1944. Well, was it June? I don't know. July? I don't know. August? I don't know. It was before school. And it had to have been after May, because you don't have any fish in those creeks until, you know, May, June, July. So my guess is, you know, it had to be sometime after May, and it could have been June, July, or August. Was it overcast? Probably, because in the summertime in Humboldt County along the coast, it's usually foggy, high fog, overcast. Don't see the sun very often. And Arcata is the foggiest spot in North America. Now, those are questions that you could ask on extemporaneous detail, and put these three together under the Kwok-Ting test, and you could test me and see, well, is this guy telling the truth or not? That's the bottom line. Now, there's a book here that I want to bring to your attention, because every student of cross-examination, looking for the truth of a matter, is trained out of The Art of Cross-Examination by Francis Wellman. It's published by Dorset Press, and we're going to take a look here at some stories. There are 23 triggers and tests. There are 23 modalities that we can use in order to examine somebody, ask them a series of questions, and determine whether or not they're telling the truth. For instance, we can use humor, details, collateral matters, memory. We can use the expose, the demonstration, flattery, confrontation, memorization, contradiction, inconsistencies, explanation, embarrassment, ridicule, the test, the hypothetical. We can use overconfidence. We can use many witnesses. We have a process called the trump card, the high point, the silent cross, the eyewitnesses, the power of suggestion, friendly, impartial inquiry, and partisanship. And each one of those techniques have been developed over hundreds of years of judicial inquiry, and they've been honed and put into a book by Francis Wellman to train lawyers in how to do cross-examination. In fact, there's a statement in here concerning cross-examination that I thought was pretty important. It says, cross-examination is the rarest and most useful and the most difficult to be acquired of all of the accomplishments of the advocate. It has always been deemed the surest test of truth and a better security than the oath. Now, you know, when they put you on the witness stand, they want you to take an oath. You know, I swear to tell the truth. So, normal people believe that, well, when somebody is sworn to tell the truth, they have to tell the truth or they'll go to hell if they lie. Well, I already pointed out to you, all of the people that stand on the witness stand and raise their right hand and swear this oath are lying. Every single one of them. And 25% of what comes out of their mouth is going to be untrue. Which is why God in the Bible, in two places, told us not to take these oaths. And then he said, I want you to testify, and when you do, let your yea be yea and your nay be nay, because whatsoever more than that comes out of your mouth, it comes of evil. And, you know, lying is evil. Sometimes it can amount to bearing false witness. And false witness now is a violation of one of the Ten Commandments. Lying isn't a crime per se, but it can be. It isn't. Lying is natural and normal, and so that's not a crime of and by itself. People lie all the time, and so you need to understand that. And sometimes when they're lying to you, they, honest to God, believe that what they're telling you is the truth, such as my example yesterday of, or day before, and I said, look at the blood. There wasn't any blood, but those two witnesses are going to die with the belief that there was blood everywhere because of the power of suggestion. And the power of suggestion is a very powerful tool that we use to elicit the truth when somebody lies. I'll demonstrate that for you right after this. Let me give you a reminder here, and then we'll take a look at the power of suggestion and how the power of suggestion can be used to elicit the truth when the witness is deliberately trying to deceive you. But first, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard in the U.S. and around the world daily over the Internet. Now, for more information about the law school and the law hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk. If you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Now, if you'd like one, just call us and ask for it. Simple enough. Number to call is 417-273-4967. That'll tell you all about us. That number again is area code 417-273-4967. We put that out so that we don't have to spend 4 hours explaining everything 30 times a day. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the law or an editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that those authors and publications that we endorse and recommend are going to reciprocate. They may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. Blame me. And they don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Now, this book that I'm reviewing, called The Art of Cross-Examination by Francis Wellman, was first published back in 1903. It's been published several times since then. It seems to me that it's still under copyright. At least it says so. It says all rights reserved and no part of this book can be reproduced by any or in any form. It's put out by a Dorset Press. And the copy I've got was put out in 1986. And I paid, this is hardbound, the one I've got here, and I bought it from a legal publisher. So it's 40, if I remember right, it was about $40 or $45. Now, somebody told me that you can get this book for about $6, $8, $10 in soft cover. You know, paperback. Now, if you can't find a copy, typically you buy this book by going to one of the legal publishing houses. I think any of them. You know, you could go to Matthew Bender, you could go to Westlaw, I'm pretty sure, and ask them, and I think they'll probably have it or carry it. If not, if you're close to, and here's Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble, they might carry it. I'm not sure they do, but they might. You might find a copy in a used bookstore. Perhaps. They're about as common as pig tracks in a barnyard. They should be just everywhere. It's been out for so many years. I mean, you know, we're talking about this book is over 100 years old. And it's just as up to date today as it was in 1903. I mean, these techniques that I'm going to share with you are just dynamite. Absolute dynamite. In fact, I've said to my students over the years, you know, the worst thing that can happen to you, the worst possible scenario that can happen to you in court, is that your opponents tell the truth about you. Because there's no recovery from that. I mean, you're just going to have to take your lumps. The best thing that can happen to you is that your opponent lies about you. Because if he lies about you, you can uncover those lies. You can expose him as a manifest liar right in front of everybody by using these 23 techniques. Now, it's a skill that you have to develop. People are not normally born with this kind of cross-examination skill like an F. Lee Bailey, but it isn't anything you can't learn. And that's where the art of cross-examination comes in. And it's why the book is so important, not just for lawyers, for anybody. I don't care if you're a truck driver. I mean, you can be a truck driver or a carpenter, a plumber, electrician, a blue-collar worker. You can be a college professor. And when you're having a conversation with somebody or you're listening to a story, a student comes into your classroom and tells you a story about why they missed the test on Friday and so on, and you're a teacher, you can use this to ask this kid 10 questions and expose him as a manifest liar. You know, and people typically lie. People ordinarily will lie when the truth would serve their purpose better. That's been my observation. And there isn't any real need for it. You know, I didn't show up on Friday because it didn't have anything to do with sickness at all. And I think you'd probably be better received, you know, if you told somebody the truth. I didn't come in on Friday because I was sick of school. I wasn't physically sick, just sick of school. Just tired of it. I took the day off. I missed the test. And the teacher's liable to tell you, well, I don't blame you. I'm kind of sick of school, too, half the time. Here, why don't you take the test anyway, and let's see how you come out on it. Anyway, Dorset Press is the place to go. And if you can't find it anywhere, then, of course, you go to our bookstore of last resort. Or you can be the bookstore of first resort if you want. It's called bravenewbookstore.com. You can get them online. They're in Austin, Texas. And their phone number is 512-480-2503. Again, that's 512-480-2503. Now, they'll get it for you if you can't get it anywhere else. And you might want to just call them first and, you know, end screwing around and get right with the program. BraveNewBookstore.com. All right. Now, let me show you a manifest fraud. Remember I told you the story about, hey, there's blood everywhere? All right. Now, that's called the power of suggestion. And my wife is very adept at using these techniques in cross-examination. In fact, that's what she did with these two witnesses. Now, you need to be honest. You know, when I went into court on that case, my wife and I both testified that we didn't see any blood anywhere. Those two women, though, didn't. They testified there's blood everywhere. And, of course, that wasn't good for our side. There should have been blood there. With all of the violence that was going on, I mean, any person seeing that kind of violence, probably for the first time, you know, would have presumed that there had to have been blood there. But as it turns out, see, the police now are very skillful at torture. Now, I'm going to use the word torture. Torture comes in many forms, and it doesn't have to be the Chinese waterboarding torture. It can come in other forms, and I pointed that out to you the other day that Larry Richards said don't make any marks on him, and I can tell you from personal experience, kids, and there are no marks. But boy, I hurt bad. And they call that pain compliance here in the United States. So if you think that torture was relegated to the rack back in the Middle Ages with Spook in The Wizard of Id, why, that's not true. And I'm just telling you that that's a fiction. Now, here's an example of the power of suggestion. And there's the story. It says, another amusing incident leading to the exposure of a manifest fraud occurred in another of the many damage suits brought against the Metropolitan Street Railway and growing out of a collision between two of the company's electric cars. The plaintiff, a laboring man, had been thrown to the street pavement from the platform of the car by the force of the collision and had dislocated his shoulder. He had testified in his own behalf that he had been permanently injured insofar as he had not been able to follow his usual employment for the reason that he could not raise his arm above a point parallel with his shoulder. Upon cross-examination, while acting for the railroad, I asked the witness a few sympathetic questions about his sufferings, and upon getting on a friendly basis with him, I suggested that he be good enough to show the jury the extreme limit to which he could raise his arm since the accident. So the plaintiff, slowly and with considerable difficulty, raised his arm to the parallel of his shoulder. Now, using the same arm, would you please show the jury how high you could get it up before the accident, was the next quiet suggestion. Whereupon the witness extended his arm to its full height above his head amid peals of laughter from the court and the jury. All right, now there's a very simple, direct, straightforward modality for exposing a lie. And the entire story occupies probably 30 lines of print. Very short, direct story. Now let's analyze this one for a minute. The guy comes into court and he says, I'm permanently disabled. You know, nobody denies that the guy was injured in an accident and is entitled to some kind of compensation. But is he entitled to retire for the rest of his life on permanent disability? And the answer is no. Now, under the old common law, you were never entitled to punitive damages. Today, we sometimes award punitive damages, you know, if it's an egregious case. But in the Bible, God requires that when you're negligent and you cause somebody a damage, that you cause him to be thoroughly healed. And the railroad owed it to this laboring man, this livery stable worker, to restore him to his health. So he was entitled to have his hospital bill paid and his medical bills and his time off work and so on. But this guy comes in and says, well, because of this accident now, I'm permanently disabled. I can never work again, you know, as a stable hand. And he comes into court and he's asking this jury, after suing the railroad, he's asking the jury to award him $50,000. Which, you know, in 1898 or 1888 is a lot of money. And so the cross-examiner here, working for the railroad, now needs to expose this guy as being a liar. He uses one of 23 techniques. When this guy comes in and testifies that, oh, woe is me, I've been permanently disabled and I can't work anymore and I need $50,000 to carry me through for the rest of my life. The jury's listening to this. And they're sympathetic, I'm sure. They're sitting there saying, well, is this guy telling the truth? Because, you know, there's a lot of people that want to retire on Social Security disability. And they lie about it. I had a woman here, neighbor lady over here, she wanted to get on Social Security disability. And see, here in Ozark County, you know, these hillbillies around here, they have a pecking order. And the highest status that you can achieve in Ozark County, the most elevated position is total disability on Social Security. I mean, that's guilt edge. When you're drawn total disability on Social Security, you've arrived. This is the promised land. You know, this is where you smoke Havana cigars and you live off the taxpayers. Now, do you want to support this guy for the rest of his life on permanent disability when he's a manifest fraud? Well, this lady over here used to be fairly friendly with us, but then when we declined and wouldn't go and testify for her that she was permanently disabled, well, then she, I don't know if she felt bad because we wouldn't participate in the fraud with her or what, but, you know, I notice now she's not near as friendly. Nice lady. She's no more disabled than I am. And then she wants to get on permanent disability because she doesn't want to work. That's what the bottom line is. And then it's just a hell of a lot easier way to make a living, you know, to have a check coming every month off the taxpayers. And that's what this guy wanted. So the cross-examiner, protecting the insurance company and the railroad, has a duty. His duty is to expose this manifest fraud, which he did, by using the power of suggestion. That power of suggestion is very, very powerful. It's a powerful tool for uncovering the truth. It's not the only one, and oftentimes it doesn't work. I mean, if this guy had his head screwed on straight, he would have said, what do you mean, raise it as high as I could before I was injured? I can't raise it right now very easily without great pain. I sure as hell can't raise it up over my head. I mean, he could have made that statement, and then the examiner would have gone on to one of the other 22 tests. You know, we can sit here and apply all 23 of these tests, this guy, if we... But you have to be kind of crafty about it. And you got to be subtle. You've got to stick the knife in, but you want to slip the knife in so that he doesn't know where it's going in or how deep. Now, that's what the bottom line to that is. Now, there's another neat story in here by Abraham Lincoln. It's the Lincoln story. It's on page 20 here of Wellman. Actually, in the Wellman book, it's on page 54. starts on page 54, but in my workbook here, it's on page 20. Listen to this story. Now, this is Abraham Lincoln. He's the 16th president of the United States. He was a lawyer. Born in 1809, he never went to law school. Abraham Lincoln was self-taught. Never spent a day in law school. And he was a fair to middle and good lawyer. And there's a story about Lincoln's first murder case. He was defending a guy in a murder case. And it's a quaint story, and it's a dynamic story. It's a tool that Lincoln used. And in fact, do you remember the series Raymond Burr played on television? Remember Raymond Burr? Let's see if I remember the name of the story here. There's some famous, I don't know, detective story or lawyer story. Yeah, I'll think of his name here in a second, but. I remember the story, Ironsides, I think it was, and I think he played this story. Well, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but anyway, Raymond Burr used to play a lawyer on TV. And this lawyer character that he played was actually taken from this first murder case of Abraham Lincoln. The style or the modality of it, where the guy stands up in the courtroom and says, yes, I did it, with this very melodramatic ending. Well, this actually happened. It actually happened. And then, of course, this author, he picked up on that, and he wrote a series of stories and books and one thing and another. Perry Mason, that's the guy, that's the character's name. I forgot the author now. Perry Mason was the series. And this guy, Perry Mason, was played by the actor Raymond Burr. Well, listen to the story here. I think you'll like it. Now, in some cases, it's wise to confine yourself to one or two salient points on which you feel confident that you can get the witness to contradict himself out of his own mouth. Now, it's seldom useful to press him on matters with which he is familiar. It is the safer course to question him on circumstances connected with his story, but to which he has not already testified, and for which he would not be likely to prepare himself prior to his appearance in court. Now, a very simple but perhaps instructive example of cross-examination conducted along these lines is quoted from Judge J.W. Donovan's book, Tact in Court. And it's mainly interesting in that it is reported to have occurred in Abraham Lincoln's first defense at a murder trial. Now, Grayson was charged with shooting Lockwood at a camp meeting on the evening of August 9th, 1845, and with running away from the scene of the killing, which was witnessed by Sovine. The proof was so strong that even with an excellent previous character, Grayson came very near being lynched on two occasions soon after his indictment for murder. The mother of the accused, after failing to secure older, more experienced counsel, finally engaged young Abraham Lincoln, as he was then called, and the trial came on to an early hearing. No objection was made to the jury, no cross-examination of witnesses save the last and only important witness, who swore that he knew the parties, that he saw the shot fired by Grayson, that he saw Grayson run away, and that he had picked up the deceased, who died in his arms instantly. Now, the evidence of guilt and the identity was morally certain. The attendance was large. The interest was intense. And Grayson's mother began to wonder why Abraham Lincoln remained silent for so long and why he didn't do something. So the people's case finally rested, and the tall lawyer, Lincoln, stood up and he eyed the strong witness in silence. Then, without any books and without any notes, Lincoln slowly began his defense by asking these questions. Lincoln, and you were with Lockwood just before, and you saw the shooting. The witness.
Yes.
Lincoln. And you stood very near to them. Witness. No, about 20 feet away. Lincoln. May it not have been 10 feet? Witness. No, it was 20 feet or more. Lincoln. In the open field? Witness. No, in the timber. Lincoln. What kind of timber? Witness. Beech timber. Lincoln. Leaves on it are rather thick in August. Witness. Rather. Lincoln. And you think this pistol was the one used? Witness. Well, it looks like it. Lincoln. You could see the defendant shoot. You could see how the barrel hung. And you could see all about it. Witness. Yes. Lincoln. How near was this to the meeting place? Witness. 3/4 of a mile away. Lincoln. Where were the lights? Witness. Up by the minister's stand. Lincoln. 3/4 of a mile away. Witness. Yes, I answered. Ye twist. Lincoln. Did you see a candle there with Lockwood or Grayson? No. What would we want a candle for? How then did you see the shooting? Witness. By moonlight. Defiantly. Lincoln. Now you saw this shooting at 10 o'clock at night in beech timber, 3/4 of a mile from the light. You saw the pistol barrel. You saw the man fire. You saw it 20 feet away. And you saw it all by moonlight. And you saw it nearly a mile from the camp lights. Witness, yes, I told you before. Now the interest was very intense. That men were leaning forward to catch the smallest syllable. Then the lawyer drew out a blue-covered almanac from his side coat pocket. And he opened it slowly, and he offered it into evidence, and he showed it to the jury, and he showed it to the court, and then he read from a page with careful deliberation that the moon on that night was unseen and only arose at 1 o'clock the next morning. Now, following this climax, Abraham Lincoln moved for the arrest of the perjured witness as the real murderer, saying nothing but a motive to clear himself could have induced him to swear away so falsely the life of one who never did him any harm. With such determined emphasis did Lincoln present his showing that the court ordered Sovine arrested, and under the strain of excitement he broke down and confessed to being the one who fired the fatal shot himself, but he denied that it was intentional. Now that's quite a story. It's a true story. And it was recorded back in, probably 1850 sometime, in a book. It was a technique that Abraham Lincoln used in the defense of a murder defendant who was innocent and who had been falsely accused. Now, this occurs about 15% of the time. 15%. The bright spot in American jurisprudence is that about 85% of the criminal defendants that are captured by the police or they're charged by the prosecuting attorney are, in fact, guilty. About 85%. But 15% are innocent. And like those five boys at Duke University, they're maliciously prosecuted by prosecutors and police, like that 30% I reported to you, of the rape convictions are done against men who are innocent. 30%. That's the highest percentage that we know of false prosecutions, of false convictions. And here's a case where the defense lawyer comes into play. Now, the reason in Anglo-Saxon administration that we have this judicial system, which, by the way, goes back to Deuteronomy chapter 1, goes back to Moses at Mount Sinai, the system of jurisprudence called the common law, Anglo-Saxon administration, comes from God himself. At the mouth of 2 witnesses or at the mouth of 3 witnesses shall the matter be established. This process of cross-examination, as usually went back in Moses' time, was done by the judges who make diligent inquisition. Diligent inquisition. Diligent inquiry. Diligent cross-examination done by judges. And listen, judges do that oftentimes today. I've been in court many times. I've been a witness many times. And the judge, after the lawyers, you know, have finished with examining me, the judge will turn and say, "Mr. Gordon, I have some questions for you." That's very, very common. So the system that has evolved over a long period of time is actually a pretty good system. Oh, I wouldn't go so far as to say that it's perfect, but this thing of cross-examination, this thing of the Kwok Ting test that has been developed over, oh, literally hundreds of years, it actually works. And that's why I said to you, now, if you're going to lie, you're going to be caught on cross-examination. And this is why defense attorneys, lawyers in general, when they go to law school, are always taught, never put your client on the witness stand and subject him to cross-examination. And it makes a lot of sense, because the defense lawyer, 85% of the time, has a guilty client. So the rule, never put your client on the witness stand to subject him to cross-examination, is good advice for all guilty defendants. You should not take the witness stand. But you 15 out there that are innocent need to take the witness stand and tell your story. And you need to have some instruction. You need to know and understand that 25% of everything that comes out of your mouth is a lie. And your opponent is going to use those lies against you and expose you as a liar. So you need to be careful that you're telling the truth. And if you're telling the truth, nobody can impeach your testimony. The best thing that can happen to you is that you get up there and you tell the truth. I was in court one time, had a student, and I thought the student was innocent. And Judge Clark, an old federal judge here in Springfield, turned on this guy, Larry, from the bench. And he asked him a series of questions, about 10 in all. And then he said to the court, he said, "I think that your supporters, Mr. So-and-so, have been sorely deceived by you." He was saying that to me. He said, "Your supporters, George Gordon, I was one of his supporters, has been sorely deceived." He was convicted. As time progressed along. And then as the testimony unraveled itself, we found out that, you know, Larry was lying. He did, in fact, fence the material. He did, in fact, avail himself of the fruits of the thefts that he was accused of. So there was the story of an old judge that uncovered a manifest fraud. Yeah, I'm about out of time here, children, so we're going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. Now, if you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. Now, for more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. We got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.